Go.
Go. Good evening and welcome to the Developmental Disabilities Advisory Board meeting, which is now officially open. As always, our business starts with community input. Do we have any community input today? Looks like most of our communities.
I noticed that out. Look, Darla's on her way though, because she's going to be speaking.
Most of the community is helpful.
Do you have anything for us? Just greetings?
It's from the community.
Yeah, it's too bad because we have some new visitors here. It'd be nice if we had more of the community here. But, okay, then the second, then we have a newcomer who we met in Olympia, Mr. Daniel Clark. Would you introduce yourself and speak to us?
Yeah. Is sitting down okay or is that okay? So I was just recently appointed to the Governor's Committee on Disability Issues and Employment as an employee of the Employment Security Department. I'm not employed right now, so this is a strictly volunteer appointment by the governor. Is anyone familiar with the committee or? Okay, so Mary, you guys probably know a lot more than I do. I had new member orientation Monday.
They wouldn't have talked about it in a long time. So.
Okay. I know nothing about this, so okay. Please tell us.
So I'm going to read, I know it's not particularly helpful to hear statements, but I'll read the mission and what the committee does. There's a succinct paragraph, so some things might stand out to you, but the mission is, the Governor's Committee on Disability Issues and Employment provides statewide advocacy and leadership to empower the disability community to obtain quality of opportunity and maximum independence. So what the committee actually does, and that's something that I'm in the process of learning, and they said for about the first year you're going to be learning what it is we actually do. The Governor's Committee on Disability Issues and Employment advises the governor and the legislature on disability issues, generates local action, initiates wide-ranging projects to address specific issues, provides training and assistance to conferences, and publishes disability-related materials. The GCDE is comprised of 27 volunteer members, who are appointed by the governor, and the majority of those people have disabilities, and they represent a wide range of physical, mental, sensory characteristics, and they're from various areas in the state. So I'm a disabled veteran, and my application, for whatever reason, they ended up selecting me to join the committee. The committee is made up of 5 subcommittees. So everybody that serves on the overall general committee also serves on 1 subcommittee. And those are the Accessible Community Advisory Committee, and that's the one that I'm excited about in part, and I'll get back to that. I've actually been assigned to the Community Outreach Subcommittee, and that's where we go into communities, determine what is a need, because there are funds that are allocated, and then those funds are provided by the state or through the fund that comes through GCDE to fund whatever project that might be within a given county. Now, the Accessible Community Advisory Committee, it's much like your committee here, but the focus is on developmental disabilities. This Accessible Community Advisory Committee is a conglomeration of all committees, or say a member from each committee, where you gather together, you therefore represent a wide range of the population who have various disabilities. The cool thing about this, Clark County doesn't have one. There's only a couple of counties that have this sort of committee that is actually approved by the county auditor. But this committee then opens up funding for different projects to be done within Clark County. So that's kind of why I'm excited to be on the outreach committee, because we go into places, we see what are things that we need. And something I just saw right away was the Accessible Community Advisory Committee. Having said that, I know how difficult difficult it can be to collaborate. You know, when I was working for ESD, I represented the veteran population, so we tried to work with other agencies who had grants from over here and over here, and there was really a vying for the veteran population rather than let's try and provide wraparound services and, you know, give them the best impact possible. So I don't know what that would look like. You know, your counterparts and contemporaries within Clark County who do similar work, but it would be a matter of creating one of these committees which the outreach subcommittee could facilitate and bring to fruition. The three others are the Governor's Employer Awards Subcommittee, and they have an annual banquet where they recognize employers who go out and make an effort to train and to hire those with disabilities. There's the Membership Subcommittee, and those are the guys that basically interviewed me, my references, went through the packet. And the final thing is the Youth Leadership Forum, and this is a 6-day long, basically like a summer camp for youth with disabilities. And it sounds like it's pretty amazing. It's fully funded. They go up to a campus near Bellingham, and these students learn leadership skills. From what I've heard, it's very empowering. A couple of the people serving on the committee right now, the governor's committee, actually went through that program and said it was life-changing. There's applications that do go out, but what was mentioned on Monday is that these applications typically don't leave, they don't get distributed throughout the schools to different teachers. The information just doesn't get to the teachers. So that's one thing that's been addressed that is a real issue.
Can you get something to me and I will get it to the right people to get it out, plus these guys?
Yep, you say you do that.
Yeah, I think I did send out something for people who were vision impaired, but if this is as general.
It covers, and my understanding is the governor's committee is completely inclusive in that way. They try to have a positive impact for the greatest population, where it's not just solely focused on mental illness, developmental disabilities, hearing, hearing loss, blindness, that they try to really represent and advocate for all populations.
Does your funding come from the government?
So, interesting, the funding comes through parking tickets somehow.
Shouldn't feel so bad, right?
Let your meter go over and just, it's going to a good cause, I guess. There are some full-time Employment Security Department employees who really are the overhead of this committee, but everyone else that serves is in a volunteer status, and typically they're involved, their work involves working in some field.
Does Toby Olson work for Employment Security?
I believe he does.
Yeah. Somebody should have been giving him a phone.
So your office, that office, is in Olympia then, or what?
So the office we were at on Monday is actually in Linwood. We met in, where did we meet for the first time? Gosh, I can't even remember. But it was around Olympia where we met the first time. The committee meets 3 times a year. General membership meeting. One thing that is extremely interesting, there is going to be an executive order coming out, and I think this speaks volumes of the governor. I don't know him, I don't know his policies, but just from what I've heard, I'm being in that category of having a disability. They're changing the name from the Committee on Disability Issues in Employment to Affairs in Employment. Although it sounds like it's just a small nuance, it more aligns this committee with other civil rights groups. So there's going to be an executive order coming out, and it's going to change this committee's name from the Governor's Committee on Disability Issues in Employment to Governor's Committee on Disability Affairs and Employment. And the intention behind that is to align this committee and what it does with other civil rights committees, and I'll just speak for what.
Good.
Do we have committees like ours in every county?
Yes.
So why, I don't understand this. What?
It's a statute that said you want the legislature in 1967 and 1975 said that you can appoint a citizen advisory committee to make recommendations to you. Otherwise, you should do the work yourself. County commissioners, and they all said, "Oh, we're going to get citizens to recommend to us," and it was a good idea.
Yeah. I just wonder how, you know, if this is a non-profit or makes sense, but if the government's, you know, can help you both, I don't understand that.
Well, mental health has changed. Like in Clark County, the mental health board is way. We have become early adopters, so we no longer at the county have. The same behavioral health kinds of boards that we had a year or two ago, because now that managed care organizations do the greatest book of treatment business. We still manage local funds and things like that, but
But how, I just don't understand, they're doing the same thing the counties are doing, but they do it on you guys do it on statewide, or?
Theirs is a little different focus. I mean, we're really focused on employment and babies and things like that. They're focused for a broader community that doesn't always, like the deaf community doesn't have an advisory committee for adults, probably wouldn't want one.
And my understanding is that, say, that this advisory, accessible community advisory committee, it could be comprised of different agencies. I don't know that it's necessarily a government agency.
Right.
So it could be representatives from various, but they somehow are a stakeholder somehow. That's my understanding.
No, it's not. I'm glad you're coming. I hope we can collaborate. I just don't understand how this is possible.
Yeah.
Because it seems like it's double duty or whatever. Yeah.
One of the things that happens when you collapse them all into one, over the years this has happened, when traditionally counties had boards for substance abuse, mental health, and developmental disabilities, there was always so much to do with mental health and substance abuse, they never got to developmental disabilities. So even though we were talking about employment, if you went to a smaller county, much smaller counties that had combined boards, most of them finally have separated them out because there wasn't enough time in the evening to get to everything.
So when you give awards away, what month is that?
It's in October, isn't it?
All I have is last year's thing. Yeah, October 7th.
Right, so we should nominate something again. One year, our county, a previous county administrator got something. Nobody's ever, we should nominate Mark for something.
The application process is not extremely lengthy, and that's what they told me is to try and promote getting people recognized within the county, getting students sent up to the county, all kinds of stuff. Because
so we have to invite you, you have to invite us.
It's an application process.
I'll get
the information to Mary. So typically, I guess it goes through the school system.
For the youth, for the youth.
That's.
Yeah, but that's not the most effective way to get, if you just send it to the superintendent, you know, or even sending it only to the special ed director, you may not, it may not get a lot of paper, it may not get.
Yeah.
But we can get some things down here, we'll get it to the people that Susan can take care of campus.
Do you have any idea, Damian, what the timeline is on that youth application for the summer opportunity?
June was last year's, and she says she always ends up extending, so Debbie Hines, she is, you may not, okay.
She's a support staff for Toby or something like that.
Yeah, so I'm not sure of the structure.
But there's plenty of time.
But yeah, there's plenty of time, and it's, again, the application, from what they shared, I haven't seen it, but it's not incredibly lengthy or difficult, yeah. And family members or caregivers, they provide everything, so it's a great opportunity, I didn't know about it.
And this is for kids at school, right?
Yeah, they extended the age up till age 21, because they have not had enough participation, the word's just not getting out.
We can provide.
So it'd be awesome to have a whole Clark County cohort.
Hello, consult applicants, can they go?
Pardon?
Consult applicants, can?
I imagine if you qualify within the parameters and you fill the application.
You probably have to be the right age.
But you gotta be the right age, yeah.
What is exactly the age you have to be?
Up to 21, it was high school age, so I guess is that 14, 15 maybe, to 21?
I'm above that.
Just.
We'll get you a skateboard and.
They should extend that to our students advocates that are higher up in like in their 30s, you know, 40s generation, that's about where I fit.
And there may be stuff available on that, maybe one of those, what do they call it? One of those projects that we can do in the community outreach.
Right.
It really, from my understanding, they have $200,000 set aside for these projects, it's just sitting there. There are no ideas.
Oh, we have ideas.
They are not receiving ideas, the funds are just staying there.
Oh, we just need to.
You're the right talking, Mr. Clark, you're in Clark County here, Wilton. So, do you have an office here?
It's just me. I'm not very extravagant.
You have a car?
I don't have a car.
Yes.
I'm not working. I'm at home with my, I'm not working for ESD anymore, I'm at home with my little five-year-old. I plan on going back to work when my wife's done with school this semester, so.
Couple of questions, one, are you aware of what we do here for
employers?
No. That would be a good thing to learn about, because we have a really big thing that we do in October to award employers different categories for the work that they're doing and the employees. So that's something we've been doing for quite a long while. And so it sounds like one of the major emphases is on employment, right?
Yeah.
So what exactly is being done in that? Maybe this is too early.
Yeah, Monday was orientation, so I have a lot to read through.
Yeah.
But I'm planning on attending these meetings now that I know about them. We met just a few weeks ago, so.
I'll get you some information too about what these guys do.
Okay. We have great staff.
A good connection.
Yeah, so I had never heard of it. We met at the reception there. You're doing employment in Clark County. Come to the meeting and let us meet you, and you meet us. And thank you very, very much, Damian. And we hope you're a frequent attendee, and also if we can Mary and her staff can help you. That'll help us, I think, too, right?
Mm-hmm. And I can send you lots of information.
Not too much.
Not too much. Are you saying maybe a little bit at a time, dribbling in? Okay.
Thank you. So Darla's on the agenda, and but I know you're next, but are you from, do you have anything to say? Because community input's always first. And excuse us, okay. Would you, Bianca from PBR?
I'm going to stand. I know most Southern people are loud. I am not. I inherited my dad's soft-spoken voice, so I think it would probably be more appropriate if I do stand. So some updates with DVR. I'm probably an update. I'm the new supervisor. I've been in this role since September 1. Big shoes to fill with Cindy Williams. I think she was there for 37 years. Yeah, so I'm up for the challenge though. I was a DVR counselor lead and senior counselor in Mississippi for 7 years before coming here to Washington State. Was here about a year and a half and they snagged me up to be the supervisor. So I'm thrilled for it. I love Washington and so appreciative of all the partnerships within the state. And I compare that with Mississippi because they're not lacking, but it's different. So I'm just so appreciative of it and to learn so much. So so some of the updates with DVR. I know that some through the WIOA, there are pre-ETS, I think it used to be called PETS, and so there was a lot of people that thought, well, that's a terrible acronym to title for our young folks, so we have changed it to pre-ETS, and so we have a business consultant now who is a former counselor, and they represent each county, and I think Emily has quite a few schools right now, and what she is doing is she's connecting with those schools to see what the needs are in those schools. Do they already have services in place, or does DVR need to come in and help facilitate some of these and start developing some programs within the schools where they're most needed? There's two pilot projects that are underway, and I was going to learn about it today, and they had to cancel because there was two people that were sick. The other thing that, I wish we were a month ahead, we have an update with pre-ETS. For the summer, we haven't quite beefed up what the kids are going to be doing for the summer, and so there are some, our contracts start the beginning of June, so that's why they're doing it, so they can implement these new services. But part of them are going to be work-based experiences where they're paid, which is going to be a huge incentive. They initially didn't have that in the start, and so it's hard to motivate a kiddo to go out and learn and have those exposures, and they're just going to do it for free on a volunteer basis. Some will, but to have that incentive of pay is going to be great. And they will have the support of a CRP if it's needed. So that's that added support that they will have if they need that as a job coach throughout that process. So if they need those supports, DVR can help assist with that as well.
Tell us what the PRETS stands for.
Pre-employment, it's pre-employment and transition services.
Okay, thank you. And is that going to include, that will include students with developmental disabilities?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, age 14 to 21, depending on when they're
out there. Yes, ma'am. You mentioned Emily. Is she somebody that's local to your office, or is that a regional position?
Emily, she's local to our Vancouver office.
Okay.
And she covers from Clark County almost up to right past Longwell, past Kelso, so she's all the way to the coast. So she's, yeah. They have six or seven people statewide in that position, and I anticipate more. I really do. I think it's going to be needed for the coverage that they're, right. If you think just about Clark County, we have a tremendous amount of schools, and so to touch each one of those, I think, in the spirit of what we need to, that's later on, I'm sure. But
also, the sure. County has projects, transition projects going with school districts, mm-hmm. So that might be a good connection to make
okay.
with us. And make those, some of those connections, maybe.
The next meeting for that is April 10th.
Can we talk to one?
Yeah, we should talk about it.
As part of that paid work program that the kids will be doing in the summer, are you going to be providing some benefits analysis so they know how that paid employment is going to affect their services long term, so we make sure that they don't build up their SSDI to a point that it's going to mess it up before they get into their SSI and their Medicaid and their long-term supports and services?
We absolutely can. And we have we have Plan for Work out of Oregon. We utilize them, but we also had one person, which is Area 3, which is covers for DVR, that covers CTEC all the way down, all the way to the coast, one person. They have hired 5 additional people for our area. So it's really the turnover on it is, it used to be we would schedule out 4 or 5 weeks sometimes because of the workload of it. And as some of them are being trained, but we're seeing that decrease to 1 to 2 weeks, which is great. And I anticipated going down even maybe within a week to get that, because when someone gets a job, they need that analysis, they need that information immediately, not 3 weeks into the job or a month into the job, and they need to report. So it's important to get that information beforehand. We're actually required, we're supposed to, or the counselors are supposed to, before they are put into plan, to have that benefits planning. But sometimes it changes depending on the job, what they're going to do. Sometimes they want to change from a full-time job to a 20-hour, so we've had a benefits planning, but we need to go back and maybe have a refresher. But we're required to have a benefits plan unless they refuse because they have the supports, but we're required to do that before plan.
Okay, I would just encourage you, not all benefits planners are equally made.
I agree.
So, Plan for Work has been, it's unfortunate that they've been telling people not to work. So we have not been encouraging people in the adult system to go. Well, I've already talked to their contract holder.
This is the Disability Advisory Board.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
We have our counselors that are in with those meetings. So I would think that if that was the discussion, I think it was in a pretty red, large red flag for our staff.
Yeah.
But that's unfortunate. The other ones that we have are within DVR. So that would definitely not be the message.
Well,
unless it was appropriate, because on occasion those are appropriate. But that's with eligibility and all that, not with a benefits specialist sharing that information.
It's not a good setup, and they're very spread very thin, and they're from another state. So it's just a plan for disaster. But just, they already know. We've had the discussion, so if you tell them I said that, they'll know that.
We've utilized it because we had the one with our DVR staff. So instead of having them have that benefits planning months and months down the road, we've utilized what we could. But it's great that DVR are going to have those 6 people within our district. We have a counselor that we were unsure whether or not part of RIOA it was to partner with WorkSource, and so we have a counselor that is going to be housed in the WorkSource. So that's a great opportunity for our customers to not to go to many different places, but to really be that one stop. The other thing that the biggest thing that I'm working on is trying to streamline. I can't do anything about policy with DVR. That is way above my pay grade, and I want to keep my job. But streamlining the services that we have are so important to me, and I bring a lot of knowledge from knowing other states and what those DVR agencies do. An example of that would be, we would have somebody come into, we have a group orientation, and everybody just gets piled in there on a Wednesday, and then they don't see a counselor for 1 to 2 weeks. And so our eligibility is 60 days, so they might see that counselor one time in 60 days. We're not going to do that anymore. We're going to do one-on-ones. So we've done, I'm doing away completely, and that's starting next week. So my staff is a little nervous. But we're going to do one-on-one. I think that will, with the varying disabilities that we have with people with PTSD and everything, I think it can create a barrier. And I don't know if we foster good customer service by just lumping everybody in a group. So that one-on-one will really individualize what those concerns are, really get that individualized information, because DVR is not, we are very gray. So it's very important to get that individualized information on those one-on-ones. So we're starting that, and just so that we do see them that first initial time within 5 days. So when they connect to DVR, they are going to see a counselor in 5 days, within 5 days. And then their next appointment would be within 2 weeks. And then their next one is all the eligibility stuff. So we're going to do all that paperwork, but we're still going to be seeing them during that time. Because boards do intake, and we don't hear back for 2 months. And that's, you know, that it's, we want to catch them when they're really motivated in that first moment or those first few weeks to keep them engaged. And I just think that's such a crucial time. We lose customers by them just, we're doing stuff in the background, but they're not doing a lot. So we want to re-engage them. So that's one thing that I'm starting next week. So wish me luck. I think it'll be great. And then just trying to reach out to most of our consistency is extremely important to me. What one counselor says, we want to make sure that we're individualized. I mean, yes, but the processes, the paperwork, how we do things, I'm really looking at each and every counselor and how we do and how we package everything and give it to our customers and our provider and our partners to make sure that we're consistent. And there's areas that we're not, that we need improvement. And so I'm working to try to implement that. And part of that is we utilize so much of our job coaches, and we have different agencies, and each counselor has their own sort of flavor to that. And I really want to start to streamline that and make it more cohesive. So we're working on that. That's my update, so if anyone has questions.
So things are, deserving of applause.
Well, yeah, it sounds like there's some things moving in the right direction, so that's good.
They got somebody that loves me. I'm a lifer. I will be there. I'm only 42, so I got a long way before retirement. But it's my career. I love it, and I understand the purpose. And so if I can do whatever I can do to help facilitate that for our customers, I'm there. So.
Okay. I have a question. Yes. Did I hear the words order of selection or the DVR
may need,
not out of your mouth, not out of your mouth, but I don't know if that is that something that it could be coming or is there an issue? Or
it's been tossed. And the reason why is right now we have carryover money for.
And can you tell us what order of selection is, just so that everybody knows?
Order of selection is we DVR in nature are supposed to support those most significant. So we have three categories: most significant, significant, and non-significant. I don't even know that the state of Washington even recognizes non-significant. Mississippi and a few other states do. So we operate really under most significant and significant. And it really is how many functional limitations does that customer have coming in based off their disabilities. So three or more would signify a most significant. So if there are funding issues, so we feel like we can't serve all of our customers, we would go into order of selection and serve only those in most significant. So it's been tossed because currently we have carryover money that's helping us with the 15% of DVR's budget has to go to the pre-employment services. And right now we're okay because of the carryover money. once that's gone, there's, so we're, I think, on a state level, they're working on how to, where we're spending, they're doing analysis to see where we're spending money, how we're spending that, where we can change that so we don't go into voter selection, but it's, I'm unsure whether or not that would happen. It's been, I think, 2001 or 2002 in this state that we were in voter selection. Yes, and it's not to say that they won't get served. They're put on a list, and once that comes open, then they, yes.
I have a question. How do they determine which is significant and what's not based on, you know, what criteria establishes them to decide what is and what isn't?
So there are different functional limitations. So say somebody comes in with a disability. Mm-hmm. We're going to look at the functional limitations of that specific disability. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's somebody that comes in with that's in a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. So are they so that they have mobility issues? Maybe they have maybe they have another disability with it. So we're going to check off as many of those functional barriers to that disability. Some come in with they come in and they are they're in a wheelchair, and we can check off just one, and it's just mobility issues. So they might need some accommodations while going through post-secondary education to make sure that we coordinate with the school that they're receiving accommodation. So it's very simple, but that same person might come in and have it might have been a recent disability, and they have some depression issues, they have the mobility issues, they have maybe some cognitive issues. So as many as we check off, three will indicate most significant.
That's good.
They need more support.
That's good to know.
Well, Bianca, we thank you, and we wish you good luck in your restructuring.
Thank you so much.
It's always a
streamline. And I applaud the one-on-one orientation.
Absolutely. If you would like us to write a letter in support of that, we would be happy to.
We can do that.
Yeah.
We're doing it. It's okay.
It's set in stone, so.
Is this the first time you're meeting with these women in here?
Not Trish and not me. Oh. No, I have not met you, but it's so nice to meet you. And I love your phone caller. I'm a Sicilian, but I'm a blue.
Kindred
spirits.
You know what UBR is,
Amy? What's that?
So we are
kindred.
It'd be nice if we could get you out of juvenile rehab, but that's a different issue.
All right, Darla.
Okay.
You've got all your little smiley faces.
I have smiley faces. I have tombstones. I have walking zombies. It's, shall we say, obsession.
Like,
so do you want the ones with the tombstones on them so you can see what's already died?
Well, some of them we want to die.
Some of them we want. Yes, there's more alive. So I'll pass this one around. This has what's already died. And then I will pass this one. This has what's alive and what's a walking dead still. So now we're gonna do our best. So there's a lot on there. I don't remember. I mean, you know, guys, I've been doing this for a long time. I don't remember a year we've had this still. And you can look through them. A lot of them are really good. There's a couple RHC bills that we're really concerned about, but what's really giving us heartburn is Second Substitute Senate Bill 5201, which basically is taking the 9 months, where right now statute says you have to try employment for 9 months. If employment is not successful for you in 9 months, then you can choose community access, or you can continue to stay in employment.
Or you can get an exception.
Right. If for some reason you think that 9 months isn't going to work, you can get an exception to the rule. And that works pretty well for us down here in Southwest Washington. It works pretty well in most parts of the state. But there's two parts of the state that it's not working very well. And there's a small handful of very loud parents, a very small handful of very loud parents, who are making a whole lot of fuss about it and who have got their senators involved.
And so Senator O'Bann from Pierce County wrote this piece of legislation. There was a counterpart piece of legislation to it in the House. And then they keep putting in amendments to it. I met with one of our senators 2 weeks ago, and we felt pretty confident that because the families kept changing what they wanted, that they were going to kill it themselves and we wouldn't have to worry about it. Our second hope was, originally it said you could have community access and employment simultaneously. The fiscal note on that was so incredibly high, that would have killed the bill.
1.2 billion.
Although it would be nice if we could have both services simultaneously. We are the only state in the nation that doesn't have both services simultaneously currently.
Well, they didn't write it in such a way that it was optional if you didn't need somebody taking you out of the community. You still had to have one. Yeah. You know, not everybody wants Delco people.
Right. So, but the last substitute on this bill says, no, you don't ever have to try employment. You can just do community access if you want. The bill has passed Ways and Means because in doing so, it took, by wording it that way, it actually took away the fiscal note. And so it's passed Ways and Means. It's now in Rules, in which we have two senators, Senator Rivers and Senator Cleveland. Both are on Rules. And we've been encouraging people to communicate with them that we do not like this bill, and this would not be good for Southwest Washington and not good for our families.
And what's the number again?
It's Substitute Senate Bill 5201.
Under employment.
That's the only one in the employment section.
Yeah.
Rivers and Cleveland.
Yes.
Okay.
I will tell you that, let me look at my dates, put my glasses on so I can see my dates. The 8th is the cutoff for bills to be out of the House of Origin. That means we've got until next Wednesday, a week from today, to get everything out of Rules. So, and off, and heard and passed off the floor. So we want to try to keep this in Rules so it doesn't get to the floor. We don't want to move. That being said, Senator O'Bann, who drafted this legislation, is also in Rules. So,
who's stronger?
Huh?
I mean, we're going to decide who's stronger, who's going to stay and keep it.
Anyway.
Well, for the areas where the current law is successful, which is, you said, most areas in the state, except for two.
There's 22 parents around the state that are struggling with this, and these are parents who have their children in sheltered workshops, and it basically comes from the fact that they're angry that the sheltered workshops are shutting down and their kids have to be in official employment.
We did this issue, you know, and the last one died in 2003, so we did the angry parent thing in 1989.
And so we're looking at Pierce County and Benton Franklin. So.
Yeah, I was thinking hospital kind of way.
And ultimately, I will say, our DDA office works better and in more cooperation with us than they do in some parts of the state. Some parts of the state, when families have tried to get the exception, which was written into Rule, right, they could get the exception. But some case managers in other parts of the state didn't know that existed and put up roadblocks to it and stuff. So what this is in reaction to isn't what needs to be done. It's in reaction to what wasn't being done appropriately. So, and our local office has done a great job in working with us in collaboration. And whenever there's any kind of concern, Mary's office and the local office work well. So, that's where our heartburn is. You want to hear the good stuff or the more bad stuff?
No, I'm all for the good.
You're all for the good? Okay, we have a respite bill that I don't even remember what it does right now, but it's good and it's passing through, it's flying through with flying colors, and we love that. It's going to actually limit the amount of training hours for respite providers so that our respite providers aren't getting blocked by the training partnership stuff that they're doing. There's a lot of bills around guardianship and protection that we like that are moving. If you look just under protections, look at all the smiley faces and look how many of them are in the rules. right? We've got a lot of good stuff happening. Same with guardianship, right? If you flip to the last page, because you know how I love my doom and gloom, sorry. Before we flip to the last page, I will tell you, the issue that no one is addressing with this employment bill is that it is written into the waiver language at CMS on a federal level that we have 9 months of employment trial. So our legislature can say we don't have to have this 9 months, but our waiver still says you have to have the 9 months. So nobody's really addressing that issue, although we've told them about that. We'll see who overrides who on that one. It'll be interesting. If you flip to the back, there's two RHC bills. One of them is from Senator Kaiser, and one of them's from Senator Honeyford. Senator Honeyford's is the same bill that he tries to run every year, that all respite would be done at the institution through Yakima Valley.
And it did die? It's
Walking Dead. We've tried to get this bill killed, and what I was told is that it would pass the Senate, and we needed it to get killed in the House. So we're working on that. And that has to do with Democrats, Republicans, and who's in control, and senators needing to do what they feel their constituents and their community need them to do. It is not a good bill for everyone else. I can guarantee you that a large majority of our families here in Clark County would prefer they have respite in Clark County. We don't have individuals that take their children to Yakima Valley, or I'm gonna say children, I have a 36-year-old son, so I'm being general, right? Anyone under 90?
Offspring.
Offspring, that's a great term. They're not all dependents, though. They're offspring.
OS, you have to get an acronym.
There you go, OS, they take their OS. But we have, you know, a chunk that do use Yakima Valley. But if Clark County was an option, they would much prefer Clark County versus driving up to Yakima.
Well, there's only one. What did Amy tell us? Trish isn't here. That there's like one crisis stabilization or crisis bed left in Clark County, and there's only two in the region. So there are not. It's forcing families to go to RHCs or if there's any kind of crisis.
The other thing that's happening with that, and this is Darla. Just for your benefit knowledge, sorry, I should never do this knowing that we're being recorded, but a lot of the individuals that are on the spectrum are now being served through our mental health providers for a variety of reasons, who try to medicate the individual mental health aspects of the autism spectrum. And while that works sometimes that doesn't work very well at all. Because behavior is communication, and you can't really medicate behavior for communication. So that is causing, and then side effects of meds and stuff is causing some issues, which is needing us to have more crisis stabilization so we can try and get kids off meds. So that's Senator Honeyford's bill. Senator Kaiser wrote a bill that at first when Senator Kaiser wrote it, we thought we were going to love it. Then it got tweaked, and then it got tweaked again, and then we didn't like it, and we tried to kill it, and then it got a substitute added onto it, and it's not so bad right now. But what we're told is that they're connecting Senator Kaiser's bill and Senator Honeyford's bill, and they're going to hear them as one and the same and pass them out as one and the same. So we need to kill them, and so that is something that we are working on still.
And that's the two on the back.
And oftentimes when you see The Walking Dead, it is necessary to implement the budget, right? Which means, so, you know, our legislature has all their rules and all their deadlines, and this is how you go through. Or we can ignore all those, pick it up, take it, and just dump it over here and do what we want. That's usually what they do when they call it necessary to implement the budget. And that's kind of what they're doing with these. So... that are exceeded. Yes.
What would it take to have more facilities, more beds here in Clark County so that people don't have to ship them off to that tomorrow?
Right.
That'd be nice.
But if there is also another bill, and I don't know where it's at, because we're probably not, I'm not following it, but sure. There's a bill in the capital budget to build 2 16-bed spots in Clark County in mental health. One is for to keep people out of Western State and places like that. One is more crisis, and the other would be that in between before, after the crisis, but before somebody's ready to leave again. And there's no reason we can't ask for something to be part of that in some way, right? To, especially for those people with on the autism spectrum that generally are slammed with psychiatric medication.
There's a lot of talk about, because there was the large mental health bill or lawsuit, right? So there's a lot of talk about taking, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm not sure about what I'm saying, but the second story of Yakima Valley, is it two stories? Yes, yeah, I never thought it was either, but taking a chunk of Yakima Valley and making it a place, emergency crisis beds for those with mental health issues.
For those whom? Everybody?
Those whom? I don't know. I don't know. I can see pros and cons to that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's all a moving target right now.
Yeah. But I think I'm going to bring it up in the department anyway. Like,
what about
can we find a way?
But just even a bed.
Yeah.
If you look through, Senator Hunt, or sorry, Senator Rivers actually has, I think it's under medical, has sponsored a couple of bills. Oh, are they under education? There they are. So the one that, the 5448, says that schools can't force children to go on psychotropic medication, which they're not supposed to be able to force them to anyway, but this kind of gives an extra letter there. So I thought that was good. So it's under education on the front page.
I thought paraeducators already had to have a
social. You know, they did there for a while, and then they redid it. So they no longer had to do it.
Well, now it's actually 2 years of post.
2 years of post.
Yeah, like after high school, so it didn't have to be an associate's.
I don't know what to do.
The equivalent of 2 years of college.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I meant about corrections.
And then they had to.
There is currently a substitute that's been added to the paraeducator bill that that went out, and that says that now it's just highly suggested that they have associates instead of a requirement, which they say, well, that's better than nothing. I would say that's not much different than what we have. So,
yeah.
Why waste?
And you know, there's so much. There's so many other skills that people can bring to the job without that 2 year degree. We have a young man that's been working in our school, that graduated from Campus High School last spring. But because of who he is and how he's been brought up, he does an amazing job in all of our really significant programs. And he wants to be a teacher, so it's just. Is this a win-win for everyone right now?
I can be sure about that.
Yeah.
I know a lot of, you know, a lot of parents of kids with disabilities work as paraeducators because it allows them to work the same hours as their kids are in school. And I think of a many friends who do it, and I'm not sure how many of them have an associate's degree.
I think they could be working on it, though. And oftentimes, I know what we did, and I don't even remember when it was. Dennis was there, it was way back when, and they were trying to set up the continuing ed credit so that they could work, use the continuing ed to work on their associates.
Right. And people that had been employed when the legislation was in effect to have that were grandfathered in too. They could do online trainings, right, pass these online courses in different categories. So there was all kinds of ways that
there's a brass of people out there told it. I just think of some of them, they've gone to the School of Hard Knocks, so to speak, and they're just strapped, you know, cash strapped, some of these households are.
Next week is Clery Week as far as advocacy days, and they're going to be on the floor most of next week trying to get the McCleary stuff passed through. I'm not currently pleased with the way McCleary reads around special education. My understanding, and I have not gone and read it for myself, but my understanding is that it does not do anything to increase the safety net funding, and actually decreases safety net funding in some aspects. So safety net right now, the way special education funding is funded, yeah, but what percent is it? 12.8?
It's on here.
Is it on here?
They're looking at adjusting it. Yeah. It's 12.8, and there's a bit on 13.
Yeah, and so 12.8% of every district, if you have more than that, you get funded for that 12.7. If you have less than that, you get funded at the actual rate of students you have, the actual percentage rate of students you have. Most districts in the state are running at 13% or higher, which means that they have a percentage of individuals that they're not receiving the appropriate funding for. So special education funding might be, and I'm going to use old numbers, so please forgive me, so I'm just going to use it as an example, not as a fact. Okay, but say special education is $7,500 a year on top of your basic education, which is $7,500 a year. That's okay, so that's $15,000 a year, but if you have a child who needs a one-on-one assistant or needs additional therapies and other things, you can see where that amount quickly is not nearly enough. That's where that safety net funding comes in. And my understanding is the McCleary that's been passed so far, the bills that are going forward, does not do anything to beef that up and actually fund special education students at the rate at which they're showing up in our classrooms. So that's a concern.
Here's some things I've been hearing from the mental health community is that people that are in residential, like adult family living homes, the prices of the adult family living homes are almost to the point where they can't even afford to live there. My nephew was telling me that there are people that work in the adult family living homes that they're required to have 75 hours of training or for a complete certification, and that there are people that they're hired and they work. They don't have that. They don't complete their classes or whatnot, and I don't know how they allow that to get away with that in the residential, in the adult family living home situation. And then there's abuse and neglect. He's reported some things he's seen in the adult, and he says there's usually one staff on, so it's like he was telling me, he says one way to solve that problem is that they should do through staffing, so that if something should happen like that, you know, it's like the person saying, well, yeah, you can't prove that. You never could say that. You can say whatever, but this never happened. So it's kind of, those are some concerns that I'm learning from, you know, just talking with some of the community members about things. And like I said, the cost of adult family living homes is ridiculous because there are some people, they get like $730-some, and that's, I know a woman, she said, she's paying her $2,000 to live in one, and she's only getting $62 a month to do miscellaneous with.
I think the state is probably paying the difference, and most people are capped at, it used to be 40, if it's gone up to 62, that's great, but it is a very small amount that people have to take out clothing and shampoo and deodorant and all that.
Susan, did you have a question?
What were the, you know, they were talking, there were some education bills, though. Whatever happened to those bills we were
those watching? Both, yeah, well, the one we were watching actually passed the floor. Now,
there was, it was party lines, it was 24 right. to 25 or something. Who was the 25?
The Republicans were the 25, the Democrats were the 24.
Well, that's how we have a Democratic.
No, we have a Republican Senate. We have a Democratic House, but this was the Senate, and the Democrats were trying to get substitutes put into that McCleary bill,
right.
and they were voting down every
party line. Yeah,
yeah, voting down.
One guy would stand up. I don't know what his name was. One guy would stand up and say no, and everyone would vote. So they voted all that down. Yeah. I thought we had some kind of mandate from the federal government.
No, we have the Supreme Court.
We have the Supreme Court mandate that we fully fund education, and that's not how it's worded.
Amply fund
education. And so.
Are they in contempt of that?
Currently, yes.
Currently,
and so they've been paying $1,000 a month fine, which.
$100,000, isn't it?
It's $1,000 a week, I think. Anyway, it's way cheaper than if they. Amply funded
it's a cigarette money.
Yeah, it's way cheaper for them to continue to fund it. So they're working on that. There's a lot of work going on. If you have strong feelings and emotions around McCleary and special education students, this week would be an excellent time to let your legislators know your feelings and emotions around those things. Anything else on that before I move forward? Okay. One other thing, and this really isn't legislation, but it's all kind of tied together. Do you want me to say that for later?
Which?
It's the waiver changes.
Oh, the waiver.
So currently, so through the Center of Medicaid Services, we have five waivers. Is that right? We have community protection, core, basic, SIBS, maybe we don't have it. IFS, thank you. The IFS waiver. So we have five waivers. They're up. Many of them, IFS isn't, the rest of them are up for renewal. And so I will email this. This is the management bulletin. I will email it to Mary so she can get it out to you guys. So you can look at what they're proposing to CMS to change or to stay the same on these waivers. So basically what they're looking at for basic plus core and community protection is to increase the capacity on those waivers. Now, my first response to that would be, why are we not increasing the capacity on SIDS as well? Because there's only currently capacity for 100 individuals, and there's always a waiting list for SIDS.
That's children intensive.
In-home behavior supports to keep kids in home so that they don't need to be placed out of home, which we're struggling with. Anyway, so, but they're looking at increasing the capacity on the other three waivers. They're adding chemicals to kill bed bugs on all the waivers, so that's good. We'll take that one. there's some of the services that are renamed, and you can see those when you go through there. And some service definitions are updated, and service limitations are modified, such as environmental adaptation, skilled nursing, staff and family consultation and training, and respite. I will forward this out so you guys can read through this. When you read through this, if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to call me. But I think it's important that they hear from all of us on how we feel about what they're going to propose to CMS, right?
One of the really nice things that they said is they want to capture this class of transition students. They want the schools to get those families there in March, and they can start working with the state. The case managers can work with them that early. They wouldn't do an authorization for employment until, or other adult things until June after they're out of school, but that way you could do that authorization the day of graduation.
March 1st?
Yes, that's all. So we need to, I'm trying to make sure all the schools near, I haven't talked to you.
But that's this class.
Lauren Nettles is.
Tell her that those kids need to be, this is their chance, they have a chance.
I had a conversation with one of the girls I work with, that her son's turning 21 this year. Maybe he's already turned 21. She's waiting for their meeting with DVR.
Well, it won't depend on DVR. They need to go make sure they're DVR eligible and start working on waiver. They can start now working on waiver eligibility so that it's a done deal the day they come out of school. Yeah. Yeah. So that's a good thing from the budget,
the way it works. And we're working on some transition budget dollars through the budget committee.
Would it be helpful at all if, as our body, we sent a letter regarding our support of fully funding special needs in the McClary example, and then also with this most recent one? So that there's an official letter from us, from the chair, that says that Clark County at least fully supports that and encourages that, with, you know, specifically addressed to our representatives and then also.
I think that would, obviously that's up to Mary, but I like the idea.
Mary writes it, and I'll sign it.
The world's up to Mary, right? So if we...
all in favor.
With Vancouver being a bedroom community for Portland, our percentage of special education is substantially higher than it is in other parts, because our special education services were better than Oregon's special education services, so we had a lot of families move here for that purpose that still are working in Oregon. So I think, yes, if you wanted to write a letter and state something, that it be funded at a higher level than what it currently is being funded, or that it be funded at an actual level, there's some concerns around that, because you don't want them over-identifying.
Which we've seen in the past.
Yeah, we don't want them to over-identify, but we want them to actually identify who actually is eligible for services. That would be good. And then I will send this out, and if you guys wanted to send this and encourage them to keep the 9 months in the waiver, that would be good.
So then I'd like to make a motion that we draft a letter doing exactly what Darla was mentioning.
I'll second the motion.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed?
Just one letter or two? One for the waiver.
Thank you. It should be a great letter.
You'd be good.
She'll send it, Rick. She'll send it, Rick. Thank you, John.
I nominate Ted. Or not Ted. I nominate Phil. Ted. Oh, I'm tired. I'm beeping. I'm hearing my alarm going off over there.
Yeah. We'll work together.
We'll work on it. Yeah.
Darla, thank you so much once again.
Yes.
Now the next thing is the reception group report about our trip to Olympia. And since M comes before T, Mary will start.
Well, we went up with Trish and Mary, and we're able to contact all of the legislators. Many of them were in committees, but we left notes telling them what we would prefer, and anybody that we could talk to, we talked about, you know, of course, transition dollars and just keeping all of that in place because it's critical. But it was the first time I've gone up, and it was a really good experience. They're all over the place, so we went everywhere. It was
that's where we met Jamie as well. Mm-hmm. And there was a reception there. I don't know what kind of building, what kind of room, but that's the weirdest.
It's in the Capitol.
It's the Capitol building. It's just the Columbia room. It's just a room
in the basement of the Capitol.
And it was really the organization. That's how our government works. It was like a free-for-all, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
You walked in there, and some people knew what was happening, and some didn't. There was very little direction or notices. Or, anyway, we did a message. I invited one of our senators to come. I forget her name.
Linda Wilson, I think.
Yeah, so to our October event. She said she would try to come. And we invited Damien to this meeting, and he came. Thank you very much. And it was very interesting for me the first time, too, to watch this party line. I don't care which party it is, party line voting. This appeals, and your heart goes out to it. I'm glad I don't have that job. That's all I can say.
Well, yeah, because it was all in favor yes, and then all in favor no. They sounded pretty close to me. But then, you know, the eyes of the most, you know, these had it. But it was a really interesting process. And I didn't realize that they caucused just right out that on the side of the...
But there's one thing, is they do it by decibels.
True.
And if you've got five really loud people, you can probably win every vote. I mean, some they actually ask you to raise your hand, some they just say...
Well, they go by every name, but some of them, one of them they hit.
Is that because they do that because they figure it'll just go party line again? Is that what they figure?
Sometimes people will ask them to do a roll call vote.
Yeah.
And that is based upon when they want to hold people accountable for how they vote.
Right.
When there's something that they don't want it necessarily recorded in how you voted.
Right, I understand that. But how could you tell the difference? And how do you know if there's five really loud people and five kind of, you know?
I think if it's close, you would get a roll call vote. I mean, if it wasn't going to be.
It's Brad Owens still the Senate. He changed, huh?
It was interesting. We did our job, but we unfortunately we couldn't meet a lot of people. They were all in caucus. Yes. But it was,
But as a union, they would know that transition is really important.
You were able to meet with the legislative assistants, and that's important, too.
Yeah,
no,
you met with all the assistants.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You also put the
right.
papers in front of
yep. them. Yep. Yeah. That's the important people to know.
Exactly. Uh-huh.
And they did a great job. They took the water for Clark County and got it there and talked to people. And
yeah, it'd be nice for all of us to do that, you know, on kind of a rotating basis or something. But I don't. You had a last minute cancellation. I had a last minute. I had better go. So it worked out. But yeah, it was fun. It was fun. It was good. Mm-hmm. Quite an impressive building.
It is.
I've been there. Yeah. Okay. Anything else, Meg Mary?
No.
We didn't get anything to eat or drink. We did it all.
Well, apparently, it was more disorganized than usual. Because usually there is a little more clarity about where there's even a glass of water. Because around the other side, apparently there was this year, but we didn't know.
Yeah.
Did you get one?
And cakes.
The government appointed, the governor's appointed. Walt, transit.
Yeah, just a couple quick things. One is the BIME, which is the bus rapid transit. Kicked off early January to a snowstorm and ice and crashing of the vehicle into one of the handrails right next to Clark College. We found out that the articulated buses are not particularly well suited for slippery conditions, and that's because the back trailer doesn't have a braking system for that kind of thing. And it doesn't have chains, and the drop-down chains would only apply to the very front of the vehicle. So, needless to say, it was not a lot of fun, given all of the adverse weather we've had this winter. And I don't know about you, I'm ready for Arizona. Hopefully we won't have any more. C-VAN was limited to medical necessary trips only 5 times this winter. And that's never happened to that extent, maybe one time during the entire winter where we take it to that extreme. But people are starting to get used to the vine. People are enjoying it. There's still some degree of confusion with paying off the bus as far as their fare and using the ticket vending machines. We don't take any fare payments on the vine like you do on a conventional bus. Everything is done and validated, very similar to the way that light rail is conducted over in Portland. And then we have fare inspectors that come by. I think the cattle prods are only 150 volts, but I mean, you know, hey, you short us some money, you're going to pay the price. We're informed, not enforced agency. And so as such, we always take it to that level where we say, you know, this is the reason why you're paying for this service. Please next time do so. The other thing that's coming up that's also fair related is that the Valentine's Day Board of Directors meeting, the board instructed staff to go forward with a series of open house and discussions about the elimination of the C-VAN monthly pass. And so there's going to be open houses where folks will be able to express their opinion about the elimination of the monthly pass and discussing that with staff, informing staff. There'll also be a public hearing before anything happens. Our fare changes, all fare implementation starts in September of every year, so everything will be geared up to that. As soon as I know what the dates of the open houses will be and where they'll take place, I'll email Mary so she can get the information out to you. The other thing is that today was the first day of beta testing for what is called the Hop Pass. The Hop Pass is an electronic fare instrument that initially be rolled out on fixed route only, which means that a person will take like a credit card type of device, like a gift card type of thing that can be reloaded at dozens and dozens of locations or over the internet. And when you get on the bus, you tap it on and your payment is automatically deducted from your account. C-VAN will implement something similar to that without the tap on feature because we don't have enough room for a big, huge fare box. Probably the last quarter or the first quarter of 2018. Last quarter of 2017 or first quarter of 2018.
How big a fare box do you need?
Well, the e-fare box is about by this, by that.
Because in Hong Kong, they're just real little and they put them all in the little buses too. With the octopus car, they call it.
Mm-hmm. You know, up north in Seattle, it's called the Orca Pass, which is an electronic fare instrument too. So that will be coming online right now. We're doing some beta testing, but one of the things that it will do more than anything else is allow the continuation of travel between C-Tran and by using a common regional fare. And that's part of the motivation behind it.
So if they're talking about doing away with the C-VAN passes, mm-hmm. what would replace it?
At this point in time, I don't know. I think it would just be cash fare or the straight deduction of $1.80 every time you board the bus. With the C-VAN monthly pass, theoretically, if you travel more than 16 round trips per month, then the cost per trip drops. At 16 trips per month, round trips, that is the equivalent of $1.80. That's the multiplier that's used to determine $59 per month for the monthly pass. If you were to travel 40 times, 20 round trips or 25 round trips or 50 trips, then the cost per trip would drop from $1.80 to probably $1.65 to $1.50. we have quite a few customers, I would say 200 to 300, that probably travel in the neighborhood of 75 to 100 trips per month.
So, can I ask a question?
No. Next.
So we have passes for our regular buses.
Well, with the Hop Pass coming on board, when the electronic e-fare program starts, there won't be a pass. There'll be a cap to the amount that you would pay, so that you're not going to pay as much, which is a de facto version of a pass discount.
So, in theory, under ADA, wouldn't you have to do something very similar with C-Van?
Under ADA, we can double the fare that we charge on fixed route. We never have, and I don't think there's an inclination to double the fare by the board of directors, but under the ADA, we are allowed to do that.
So is that going to eliminate, like, the punch tickets, the 10 punch tickets?
Correct. Eventually it will. With C-Van, because it's in the second phase, that won't happen until late this year or early.
What is going to take place of that?
It would be the e-fare system, and what would happen is if you were to book a ride on C-Van, when we pick you up, then the $1.80 would be deducted from your electronic account because we picked you up. If we don't pick you up or you no-show, there's no deduction of payment because we haven't provided a service.
Right, I see.
But it's a good time for you to get your concerns or something out there. Maybe, Angie, you can take this back to the, because it will impact a lot of customers that you guys serve. I'm not sure we can correlate how many people are.
Yeah, I think that's the reason why we're doing the open houses. I wasn't there at the Valentine's Day board meeting. I actually had a more important commitment because I wanted to have a place to sleep that night. But I found out about it afterwards.
Thank you for sharing.
So if someone has an annual pass and then this goes into effect, what's going to happen?
You know, I'm not sure. That's a good question. That's a good. I'm not sure how that would.
They'd have to refund or something.
Either that, or grandfather it in for that year, or create a cap. One of the things that's good about the e-fare system is that you can create incentives very quickly and easily because you're controlling it back office wise, and you can also eliminate one of the problems we have on C-Van, at least people losing their passes, or one of the things that happens quite often with group homes is people taking the one pass and using it amongst four or five people. That's completely legit. It says right on the pass it is transferable. But when they all travel simultaneously, it isn't a lot.
Yeah, but you know what happens is, though, when you, with those cars, you steal them too. Because your pass has got, you know, a piece, like if I find it, then I can use it.
Well,
like,
you can, with the pass too, you can report it stolen or lost, and it basically shuts off.
Okay.
So on the fixed route buses, a red light would go off. When you present a fare instrument that is empty or is stolen, has been blocked.
So, well, how would the electronic one work? If an individual didn't have a card, would it be up to the bus driver to recognize them? How would that work?
If you're on a fixed route bus, you would have to have a hop card. Right. If not, you could use cash. Cash is still going to be accepted.
But I'm thinking for C-Van. I'm thinking for individuals who can't necessarily manage manipulating funds.
With C-Van, they wouldn't have to have the hop card. What happens is, because with C-Van, we know who's traveling and where they're being picked up. So what happens is, back office off of our manifest, So when Trish boards the bus, you'll notice that the drivers hit the mobile data terminal and hit a plus sign that says, we picked up Trish. At that point in time, within milliseconds, and I'm not joking, the money is taken, ripped out of her account and placed into our account. And if you kind of think of it in terms like Shrek and stuff like that, this big pile of coins, you know.
Would that eliminate the day passes as well?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'd be somewhat of a challenge when we have customers that they're not set up in our system yet so that we can do the monthly passes for our services. We'll provide those, we'll send them a day pass so that they can get to us.
Right. You could have a situation where you could ask the driver for a day pass, and what ends up happening is that electronically the $4.25 is deducted from their account, and they'll get a transfer that is then able to use for the whole day. I think that that's how it's going to work. That's on fixed route. On C-band, it would be a situation where, okay, I want a day pass, and so we deduct the $4.25. And so at that point, no further deductions would take place. We're going into a whole new world.
We're waiting for the date of this, of these town halls.
Correct, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you think they will be before the next board meeting, or?
You know, I have no idea. Before I talked to the public relations manager, Chris Selk, yesterday, and said, do we have dates, timelines of the open houses? And we did.
So
it's going to be very important that people are part of that discussion.
I mean, I get the fixed route, but with the C-band, then they're going to have the electronic card that, or
they will have to have the electronic card.
They can pay cash.
They can pay cash.
Or,
see, the current fare box that we have on C-bands are just a glass tube.
Sure.
That will still remain in place. Unlike fixed route that has a brand new electronic fare instrument that you can tap on and tap off. Mm-hmm. The equivalent of tapping on and tapping off is done when we pick you up. Oh,
okay.
Yeah. Okay. And at that point in time, electronically through our software called Trapeze Pass, it will go to what is called Easy Wallet. And then your money is taken from you there. So we're sticking our hands in your wallet, taking some money out.
Okay.
No, that's what the software is called, Easy Wallet.
Any other questions for Walt? Any other new business? Nell.
I received something from Jennifer Mathias, the housing coordinator for the ARC at Southwest Washington. And I just thought I'd pass this on to you because I think it's important. It has to do with housing. And City of Vancouver is considering making updates to the accessory dwelling unit rules, ADU. An accessory dwelling unit would be where something like Ted has done for his son. And I think Clark County is probably worse than Vancouver, but these rules have not been updated for many years, and so they feel like it would be important to revisit that. And I mean, Ted can tell you, you know, the benefit that they've received from having that unit for their son. And
since they're outdated rules, we build with all old materials.
So the standards haven't been updated for more than a decade. There are considering updates to provide continued flexibility for homeowners, help address housing affordability needs. There will be an informal open house to collect community feedback on potential updates scheduled for Tuesday, March 7th, next week, 5 o'clock at the Vancouver Housing Authority, 2500 Main Street And so this is an important issue. And so if that's something that interests you, I would encourage you to go.
Are you going to?
At this point, I'm planning on it, yes.
Is Jennifer, does she know, is she going to go?
I don't know.
You should have better ask her.
She was not at the meeting Monday.
If I could add something, I was fortunate enough to attend the Commission on Aging Housing Summit in about a week or so ago. And I recommend, if you have the time, is to go online to CBTV and to look at the presentation by this economist that was presenting to the group. Keep in mind the context. The context was developers, real estate people, and elected officials talking about the overall dynamics of housing in Clark County and across the United States. It's not particularly uplifting, meaning if you have anybody that you know is trying to find a home, they already are telling you horror stories about how expensive housing is. But the presentation from this gentleman, Elliot, can't remember his last name, was extremely good and very informative and gave you a perspective of what kind of situation we're in, and in turn, what could be some ways that the county, the city, and the private sector could try to address the issue. Again, it was the Commission on Aging Housing Summit. It's currently right now on CBTV, so if you go to, I think it's cbtv.org or something like that, I'm not sure what the website is, you can see the different segments that are a part of that.
Does that cover for people who already own their own homes?
Well, the focus is talking in terms of why the dynamics are the way they are. And what are some of the reasons why the dynamics that we currently see, which is rapid growth in cost, the unaffordable nature of housing right now, and some of the background to that that I found.
So would that apply to like recent homeowners, because you know that I own my own?
Right, I'm not sure if it would. I think it would give you a perspective if you were thinking about understanding the overall position of housing in the United States and how difficult it is. You know, one thing I never associated with is that when we had the housing crisis of 2008 and 2009, what happened is a lot of skilled craftspeople decided to leave the industry, and a lot of developers decided to leave because they weren't making any profits and that kind of stuff. Now that it's rebound, where you used to have maybe 30 or 40 different builders in a community, in our community, we may now have 2 to 5. And so whenever you have a dynamic like that,
supply and demand,
it comes back down to supply and demand. And then in turn, the other thing that was interesting is that the dynamics of what regulation will do is basically added another $100,000 to the cost of a home. And so now, if a builder wanted to build something and make a profit, where the market is $300,000 and above.
Right.
You know, so they're focusing in on that market. The problem is there's a lot of people that can't afford a $300,000.
No,
I mean, and so you have this push me, pull me. It was a very interesting, I mean, presentation by this gentleman. He's an economist out of D.C. Don't expect to be, you know, dancing with the hippos afterwards, because you're not going to feel like dancing. But
unless you want to.
Elliot something or other. I'm sorry, I can't remember
That's
his
okay.
last name. It was a very interesting summit, and, you know, it is a very difficult problem. And I definitely didn't walk away overjoyed, because right now we have my son and daughter-in-law and grandson living with us, and they're trying to find a house. And so I soon realized that they're going to be there a little bit longer.
Well, one last comment about the successor dwelling unit is that, so the rules and regulations that are imposed on a homeowner that makes it terribly expensive just to add a little bit onto their home. And so hopefully they'll be addressing that they can cut back some of that and make it a little bit easier and less expensive for someone. I do know that my wife and I were considering doing something like that with our house, and we did not follow through on it. But sometimes just getting a permit can be tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah. Well, they're called ADUs.
Right.
Okay. What's interesting is that Lanier Homes, which is a nationwide builder, have these type of arrangements built in. So when you buy the home, we were actually thinking about buying a home that was one of those homes, with the thoughts that eventually my in-laws would be moving in, and they would have their segment of the house, separate entrance and all that kind of stuff. So there's some people doing it right now. There's the tiny homes.
Right now there's the counties, different than the city,
yep,
different than the state, so all the different lines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Going to happen, though there's more annexation that will be in effect in August. So,
Vancouver's taking one of the counties?
Vancouver, along the north area, up to the Skyrim and Costco. Wow.
I hope they don't take over mine.
No, there was an area that was really up in arms. I think it's around the golf course or Green Meadows or somewhere in there.
All right.
They could create like apartments and kind of change the nature of their neighborhood area. So it's going through. We got the email.
We did.
It's going through. And the county has planned for it in the budget, so there will be cuts to county employees and staff, et cetera, because they planned for it in their budget. So
we have a whole 120 new units coming where we are in the green pit. And they asked us what we thought, and we told them, but they didn't listen.
Well, that was one of the things that Gary mentioned, was the whole concept of infilling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And how we need to change our thinking about infilling, because by ignoring that, then you're also ignoring some of the dynamics of housing. But, I mean, like I said, it was very depressing. It really was, it's a good cry.
You said he was from New York?
No, he was from Washington.
Okay, so.
Yeah, and in fact, he lives one of the examples he gave was, he lives in Maryland, and he wants to move with his son into a condo in D.C., and he thought he had plenty of money. He had like $500,000 set aside, and found out when he talked to his real estate agent, there were only two condos in all of Washington, D.C. that he could afford, that were at the price point of $500,000.
Wow. I bought mine for $15,000.
Well, I mean, that's good, because that's one of the issues that we're seeing. It's right over here off the fourth plane.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we're seeing affordable housing.
I didn't stay in the Vancouver area. I had to go further out towards more like Woodland and Kalama area. And I've learned the further you go out, the housing price just a tad bit better the further you go.
But the problem is, as you probably experience, is then transportation becomes an issue. You know, I curse every time I have to fill up my truck, and I live in Richfield.
Right.
You know, it's those kind of things.
Yeah, I have to take.
Oh, yeah, we have to get the the room now.
Okay.
But I have one other thing to announce. This is a, for anyone interested in positive changing, training around behavior, this is a flyer offering, this is to train people to be behaviorists. I'm sorry. So if any of you want to know how to be trained to be a behaviorist.
Be a skilled.
No, not that kind. Registered Behavior Technician.
And yeah, that's basically it.
I don't know.
Thank you very much. This meeting is now adjourned.